He has also organized two cyber conferences for the Case Economic and Social Research Council on the public understanding of science and peer review in the social sciences. He is also a co-investigator in the Ford Foundation project on social sciences at risk and the Gubelkian Commission on the Future of Knowledge in the 21st Century. So with Steve, we have a key scholar in the field of science, technology, society here, and we would like to warmly welcome you to the first of your three talks. So, the floor to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dirk, and thank you all for showing up this afternoon. It's a fine afternoon, but what I'm really pleased about is that so many of you are so young, because I think the kinds of issues that I'm going to be raising today are ones that are going to become increasingly important as this century moves on, and that explains the title of the three talks I'm going to be giving, which has to do with the social sciences in the 21st century in light of the challenges that are going to be brought to us by what's called the Converging Technologies Agenda. And I will explain what that is. But since I imagine that this agenda is rather new to most of you, as I'm talking about this, because I'll be talking not only about contemporary issues, but also about their historical rootedness and some of the underlying deep philosophical concerns that they raise, because we're basically talking about the future of humanity. What does it mean to be a human being in light of our enhanced technological capabilities? You know, and what I mean here is biotechnology, nanotechnology, information technology, and the improved knowledge that we're getting in the cognitive and neurosciences. Okay, and what does that mean in terms of our understanding of humanity? So as I'm giving this talk, I have no expectations about exactly how much I will be covering today. Okay, so in other words, as I'm talking about things, if there are certain issues or certain terms that you don't understand that seems to be impeding your making sense of what I'm saying, put your hand up, and hopefully, you know, if it's a reasonably brief question, I'll take it so that everybody can sort of be on board with this, okay, and understand what I'm talking about here. Because I do think it's very important, but it's also quite new, and in a way quite strange. Also, what I'm going to do, I have PowerPoints. I'm actually recording the talk audio, and I plan to put the PowerPoints and hopefully the audio recording on my own website, which you can then access afterwards. But for the most part, I'm going to take advantage of this, what we've got here, which is a Word file. And from time to time as I'm speaking, I'm going to just type things that I'm saying, okay? Key terms and stuff like that, because I'm sure there'll be some things that won't be known to people. Okay, so the first point here is this phrase, converging technologies, okay? This is not a phrase that philosophers cooked up, but is in fact policymakers cooked this up. And in fact, this is a recognizable phrase in both the European Union context and in the U.S. National Science Foundation context. And in fact, the European Union concern about this issue is in very, to a large extent, a direct response to the National Science Foundation's interest in this. You may recall a few hours ago when we had Framework 7 of the European Union projects being displayed, you saw nanotechnology as one of the areas that are of concern. Okay, that gives you a sense of how much this agenda has kind of permeated the entire policy thinking. So in other words, this is the name, you might say, of a certain kind of general orientation that is going to influence science policy across all the disciplines that major funding councils on both sides of the Atlantic are doing. I was part of a Framework 6 project looking at the knowledge politics of converging technologies, and I put on the website for this course an article that appears in the latest issue of the journal Innovation, which basically encapsulates a lot of what I've come to think about this, not only on the basis of interviews that I've done with people working in this area, both in the social and natural sciences, but also based on historical and philosophical reflections. Okay, so this is a big deal, and when we talk about converging technologies, very often we bring in a set of initials here, NBIC. Okay, NBIC stands for the four main fields that are involved. And let's see if I can conjure up my. Can you read it as it is? Okay. Now, what I've got here is a quote that comes from the original Converging Technologies document, which the National Science Foundation put out in 2002. It's a very long document; it's about 400 pages long. And in a sense, this was presented as a new consolidating research agenda for science in the 21st century. Okay, and it was meant to do a lot of things at once. And I think this is worth talking about here. First of all, there's been a general recognition since the end of the Cold War era, so at the end of the 1980s and onward, the last 20 years, that the generally speaking, research funding and research interest has shifted from the physical to the biological sciences. Okay, and of course, there are all kinds of reasons for this. And largely having to do with commercial concerns and to a large extent reflecting a kind of shift in the way in which people are thinking about science policy funding, namely, you might say, making it more client-oriented than it had been in the past. And so with things like biotechnology, there are clear client bases, right, in the medical and health communities that research can be targeted toward. Okay. Now, at one level, this has created an interesting kind of labor problem for the scientific community. Okay, in particular, physical scientists are underemployed. Now, this part of the story may sound a little cynical, but I think this is very much part of what's going on here. When we talk a lot about fields like nanotechnology, you should partly think about this as a kind of rebranding exercise, right? For physicists and chemists who are having a hard time actually finding work in the traditional fields in which they were trained and in some way need to become more relevant to what is becoming an increasingly biotechnology-oriented science frontier. Okay. Nanotechnology is another name for chemistry, actually. And what it literally means, nanotechnology, right? It comes from the Greek root nano, 1/1,000,000,000th, right? So it is looking at matter at the level of 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. And why is that the unit? Well, because that is thought to be the smallest unit of matter where matter retains its functional properties. Okay, that means you can intervene with something at that small a level, right? Make strategic interventions and have the desired effect, because it is somewhat larger than the quantum level, right? Where indeterminacy reigns, and you know, if you interact with it, you're not necessarily going to get any determinate outcome. But here, it's a little bit larger, but still quite small, so you can make very strategic kinds of interventions, which end up having the effects you want. So when one talks about the kinds of developments in nanotechnology that have actually happened, because a lot of this, of course, is still quite speculative, so this is very much an agenda for basic research, you might say, but basic research where there's a long-term promise that it will enhance human performance. Okay, to use that phrase that gets used a lot in this discussion, enhance human performance. But it is a basic research agenda at the outset because this stuff is still very much in the making. But some of the things that we can do at the moment that is of biotechnological relevance from nanotechnology is we can create these little things called nanobots. So nanotechnology robots, nanobots, right? That you can put into your bloodstream to clear out your arteries. You know, you have fatty deposits in your arteries that can lead to arteriosclerosis and other kinds of heart disease, right? You can manufacture these little molecules, right? Nanobots, right? And then send them in there, right? And they'll clear arteries for you, kind of like clearing the drains, right, in your sink, right? That's what they do. And you can engineer these things, right? Because and they're sufficiently small that they get the job done, right? But they're not so small that they'll end up having all these very perverse effects or not get it done. At least that's the idea, right? So this is the promise of nanotechnology, to make these very strategic micro-interventions, okay? Now, this kind of idea has, in fact, been around for a very long time. Now, the technology to do it has massively improved over the last 20 years, but if you had a look at the article that I provided from Innovation, I have in the beginning of the article a quote, okay, that comes from 1934. Okay, I'm going to read you the quote, because in a way this quote could have just come from that National Science Foundation document that I am quoting from on the PowerPoint. Okay, so let me read you the quote. This is from 1934. So here's the quote. Can man gain an intelligent control over of his own power? Can we develop so sound and extensive a genetics that we can hope to breed in the future superior men? Can we obtain enough knowledge of physiology and psychobiology of sex that man can bring this pervasive, highly important, and dangerous aspect under rational control? Can we unravel the tangled problem of the endocrine glands? Can we solve the mysteries of various vitamins? Can we release psychology from its present confusion and ineffectiveness and shape it into a tool in which every man can use every day? Can man acquire enough knowledge of his own vital processes so that we can hope to rationalize human behavior? Can we, in short, create a new science of man? This is 1934. This was said by Warren Weaver, who is the director of the Natural Science Foundation, the Natural Science Division of the Rockefeller Foundation. And this was in the program statement that established the science of molecular biology. Okay, as you may know, molecular biology was basically a you might say, privately seeded discipline. Rockefeller Foundation comes in and funds laboratories on both sides of the Atlantic, one of the main outgrowths of which was the double helix understanding of DNA in 1953 in the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge, which was being funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, Warren Weaver's original idea in 1934 was to basically get a lot of physicists and chemists and move them into biology. Right? Does this sound familiar? This is exactly what's happening now. Well, this was his idea back in the 1930s. Not because there was any kind of job shortage for physicists and chemists, but rather because he thought that actually some major breakthroughs could be made in biology if there was a finer-grained understanding of how genetics worked. Because in the 1930s, genetics was understood as population genetics. Right, so it was understood very much at a kind of macro level in terms of whole populations. But there was not yet enough of a fine-grained understanding to actually figure out what it was in the genes that did the various things that caused people to behave or to be the way they are. And this is what molecular biology was going to do. But why? Well, because the idea at the end was to intervene. Right? Molecular biology was primarily going to be a science meant for intervention, very much in the spirit of what we're talking about now with the Converging Technologies agenda. And indeed, the strategy was very similar. Right? Namely, you bring physicists and chemists who have a certain way of looking at the world to examine the nature of life. See, if you were a biologist, even in the 1930s, there was a good chance that most of the phenomena you studied lived in the field. You studied real animals living in real environments, you know, kind of thing ecologists still do, natural historians. There was still quite a lot of that going on in biology. Of course, there were the population geneticists studying fruit flies and things of that kind, okay? And those people often did have very strong background in physics and so forth. But there was really no unified biological science. And since they sort of existed in one realm in the lab with the fruit flies, and then there were these more traditional kinds of biologists, very much like Darwin, let's say, right, who recorded how animals and plants behaved in the wild. And so Weaver's idea was that we were going to get this very fine-grained, physicalistic, reductionistic, you might call it, understanding of life. So you bring in the physicists and the chemists. And to a certain extent, it worked, in the sense that, you know, the genetic code was cracked, okay? But it didn't quite have the consequences that he imagined, right? In the sense that it remained for a very long time a kind of basic research discipline that kind of had its own trajectory, that wasn't necessarily being oriented toward these kind of human problems that he's identified back in the 1930s. Well, in a sense, the Converging Technologies agenda is, in a way, trying to bring all of these sciences and some new ones back into this agenda of enhancing human beings and using a lot of the same strategy of bringing more physicists and chemists into the biological sciences. So that's a general kind of strategy. And now there's a kind of additional issue about the labor market that's important. So that's very much part of the background of this, and it very much influences the American discussion of this matter. Okay. Let's have a look here this document, Converging Technologies document from the NSF, was authored by these two guys, Mike Rocco and William Sims Bainbridge. Let me put their names up there because they're quite important guys, and their backgrounds are very interesting. So we've got Mikhail, but he goes by Mike. Okay, Rocco and William Sims Bainbridge. Okay, Rocco is the head of the nanotech division of the NSF, and Bainbridge is the head of social informatics. Bainbridge is a sociologist. Rocco is a chemist, okay, chemical engineer. Bainbridge, his career in sociology, interestingly, was very much on sociology of religion. And in fact, he is very interested in ideas concerning cyber immortality. And at some point in these three talks, I will say something about this because this is very much part of the issue here. The idea of uploading your consciousness into computers so that you have a silicon afterlife. I will talk about this. See, people are already laughing, but this is part of the game. And this man, Bainbridge, does research into this area. This is what he's known for. Okay, and he's one of the co-authors of this document. Rocco has succeeded very much in getting this Converging Technologies agenda as a kind of line item on many different projects that the NSF and other American government agencies have been funding. Originally, if you look at that original document from 2002, you will see it very much tied to a kind of national security agenda. That's another very distinctive American thing about it. And remember, 2002 is just 1 year after 2001. And we all know what happened then, right? So there's this issue about terrorism. This was around the time where there were these scares about anthrax, you may recall. Anthrax in the mail. Senators getting these white powdered things, right? And so one of the things that was going to be promised by this agenda was that in some way we would be able to create a kind of biological force field around us, you know? We would be able to sort of get these nanobots protecting us in advance, a kind of hyper-immune system. You know, it's almost having like, back in the Cold War, we used to talk about having, you know, these defense shields that would be able to stop the weapons from coming in. Well, now imagine this at the level of the individual as a way of dealing with biological terrorism. Okay, this was very much part of the original agenda. This is not so much part of the agenda now, but nevertheless, there is still more, you might say, down-to-earth concerns. And it's these down-to-earth concerns that start to bring in our European colleagues into it. Now, in the American document, Converging Technologies, as I've already been sort of suggesting, and as Warren Weaver was already suggesting in the 1930s, is something very much targeted at human beings as individuals. So you protect immune systems of individuals, enhancing individuals, right? And as it were, you get a strong society from strong individuals. Okay? But the European side of this issue has actually stressed from the very beginning a much more social welfare orientation. Okay, and indeed, it hasn't stressed very much at all this kind of immortality or any of that kind of more what you might call science fiction side of it. It has not really stressed that very much. But it has stressed the importance of this kind of technology potentially in improving the welfare systems of Europe. And what I have in mind primarily is the issue of what do you do with an aging population where we still have a retirement age in the 60s, early, mid-60s. People are living longer and longer. Sometimes they're not living qualitatively better lives. In fact, they deteriorate. But they're still living a long time. It's kind of a drain on the health system. Wouldn't, you know, rather than having the younger generation having to pay increasingly for all these old people who are living longer and longer lives in more and more decrepit state, wouldn't it be just better to, as it were, improve the health of the older people so they can work longer, contribute more to the welfare system, raise the retirement age, and that way sort of solve, you know, what will be recurrent budgetary crises for welfare states in the future. So raise the retirement age to 70, 75 maybe, and have people work longer and live healthier lives. And this has been primarily the context in which this has been discussed in Europe. Now, as I say, the actual research on the ground about this, you know, in other words, what evidence do we have that this kind of a policy would work, is spotty. Okay? It's not perfect. And you know, I mentioned the example of cleaning out the arteries, but in fact, what people really would like to do is to be able to switch genes on and off, right? To be able to have nanobots that can actually get into the genome and activate certain potentials in people or stop them from happening. So they really, as it were, transform people at very fundamental kinds of levels. Okay, and not only at the antenatal level, but even after they are already alive and about. And maybe even reverse the aging process in some cases. Okay, again, a lot of this is speculative in terms of how far we can go with this, but we have been able to do this on laboratory animals of various species. Okay, so there, you know, hope springs eternal when this happens. So there's a lot of interest in this, and so then the question is going to become, okay, once we start to take this seriously, what do we make of it? Okay, and in a sense, this is kind of where I'm entering the discussion. I should say that in terms of funding this, one of the things that I have found out as I've traveled to various countries is that people have very clever ways of funding this, because at one level, it is very hard to justify this on its face because it's very speculative, and you really have to fund it as a basic research project on a very large scale, which nobody wants to do. But what we find is that, for example, in Australia, at the University of Queensland, there is the government created a kind of nanobiotech sort of semi-private company that basically makes money from patenting fairly ordinary nanotech products. Because nanotech can be used for all kinds of things, right? So it can be used to clean dirty surfaces more effectively, right? It's great, you know, enhancing your household appliances, things of that kind, which actually do make a lot of money. They're not intellectually very stimulating things to do. But nevertheless, they do make a lot of money. And so these startup companies, you might say, that the government is partly funding, right, bring in more money this way through these very ordinary kinds of uses of nanotechnology, which are in abundance, and then put it back in to invest in the more basic research. Okay. Also, there are strategies, and this was something that the people at the National Science Foundation in the United States told me, was that part of the issue, since it's this nanotech research in terms of its biological applications is very hit or miss, that to a large extent the United States is happy to let China take the lead on some of this. China happens to be the country that has that in fact publishes the most papers in nanotechnology today, but are very much of a trial and error, hit or miss thing. But once you see these things printed, you know, the people in the United States and Europe can sort of say, well, what's worth following up and what's not worth following up? And what the United States has begun to do very strongly is to invest in education pipelines. The Australians have done this as well, and this is something that's actively discussed in Europe as well. In other words, create graduate programs that enable scientists and social scientists, as it were, to orient their research, thinking in terms of putting together the various disciplines that are necessary to be able to bring about a converging technologies agenda. So if you look at the disciplines, right, we've got cognitive scientists, they're the C in MBIC. We've got the nanotechnologists, right, who are chemists and physicists, perhaps. Bio people, biologists of various sorts, and the IT people, information technology people. Now, these are people who have quite diverse expertises that are all necessary for this. And as you see from this quote from the document of the National Science Foundation, if the cognitive scientists can think it, the nano people can build it, the bio people can implement it, and the IT people can monitor and control it. That's the ideal. Now, you see, they start with the cognitive scientists. So ultimately, there is a sense in which what is ultimately being targeted, at least by the National Science Foundation document, is some kind of new conception of what human beings are about, how they think about their world, how they orient themselves, and so forth. Okay, that is very much on the top of the agenda. So this is where, by the way, social scientists and so forth come in. And there's been a strong interest in recruiting social scientists to both study and to participate in this process. Now, some of you in this room are probably or maybe part of this field that I'm part of called Science and Technology Studies. STS, Science Studies. How many of you consider yourself part of this field in some way or another? Okay, a few of you. Maybe as many as 40%. Well, this is a very interesting field, of course, and we're very much always studying this kind of cutting-edge science and technology, especially ones which have such obvious social implications. And one of the things that's very striking about this particular agenda with regard to the field of science technology studies is the extent to which we have been actively recruited into it. Okay? So, for example, Rocco here was very much responsible for establishing a vast network that exists in the United States called Nanotechnology and Society, which has many of the most important science and technology studies programs in the United States involved, which must have at least 100 researchers overall involved in studying all sorts of aspects of this kind of converging technologies agenda. Now, what does this mean, studying all these different aspects? Well, they're not just studying the scientists as they're doing their work in the lab. They're also studying public attitudes toward this. And they're not just studying public attitudes toward this. They are, as it were, contributing to the formation of public opinion in the process. Okay? So we've got a phrase that we use in our field. I think it's a bit of a euphemism, but we call it anticipatory governance. Okay? Spin. Not only is the phrase spin, it means spin. In other words, what you do is you soften people up to this stuff. This is kind of what we're doing, in fact. We're not the only ones doing it, of course. There's an enormous amount of public relations surrounding this thing, because at a certain level, so for example, at the level at which, let's say, Warren Weaver, that quote I read from 1934, that scared the daylights out of a lot of people. Okay, this whole idea of creating a new science of man, and in the original quote, man is in capital letters. Okay, this is 1934, okay? It's already scary enough without Warren Weaver entering the picture. And so the thing here is that this is potentially something that could turn people off tremendously, right? What are these nanobots? What are, you know, think about the debates in Europe over genetically modified foods, right? This could turn into a complete nightmare very easily. But it hasn't. It hasn't, okay? And if anything, people are just waiting for this stuff. When's it happening? Not soon enough. Right? And part of what's been going on is anticipatory governance. Right? So in other words, what we do in science and technology studies, and other people are doing this, is we create scenarios, we do surveys, we try to get public attitudes toward this, we publicize what the public attitudes are, and so then this provides a kind of feedback mechanism, which then enables people to think about this. Our people talk a lot about this in public media, in newspapers, magazines, radio, television. In fact, this is one of the reasons why a large number of people think that there's actually been a lot more science and technology done on this than there actually has. People have already gotten sold on this, that it's already happening, even though not so much of it has happened yet. Okay, so from that standpoint, it's a great sales job, right? You already have the demand created. Now all you need is the supply. Okay, and we've been very active in this, science and technology studies. You know, this critical field that we are, science and technology studies, remember us? We're the ones doing this. Right? Not only are we doing it, we actually have very good precedent for doing this from our theoretical traditions. Because as you know, we are post modern and post-human and post-everything, right? Right? And so in a sense, you know, if you look at our leading theorists, you know, so Bruno Latour, Donna Haraway, that'll do, actually. Right, we have a kind of intellectual climate, a kind of cultural climate within our field that is waiting for this to happen, too. And in fact, we present ourselves as really the only people who can explain this. And the explanations, of course, that we offer have to do with the fact that really there was never any big distinction between natural and artificial anyway. Right, that's a kind of false binary of those big bad modernist days that never happened. Okay, those of you who are familiar with our theoretical debates, we tend to act as if modernism is a myth. Okay, so the point is that our field is very intellectually oriented toward this thing happening too. Okay, much more so than other fields are, and I think it is to the great credit of Rocco to realize this, and that we quite happily join in this way. Also, it's very hard to be critical of all this stuff because there isn't enough of it around. Okay, so in other words, you know, there isn't enough of the actual science and technology associated with converging technologies to actually say, oh, this is a bad thing having bad effects. It isn't really there. Okay, so this is kind of the state of play with this sort of agenda. At this point, does anyone have any questions? I've been talking for about 30 minutes. Are there any questions anyone wants to raise at this point? No? Everybody's on board with this? Okay. By the way, the center for this nanotechnology and society initiative is Arizona State University. They have a website called the Center for Nanotechnology and Society, CNS, right, at ASU, right? A lot of interesting things going on there. And you see the many different levels at which they operate. And that's a National Science Foundation funded project. Now, the European response to this, and I talk about this also in my paper in Innovation. The main person in Europe who's been talking about this most consistently, and I think in the broadest way, in the most intellectually interesting way, is Alfred Nordmann, okay, who is a German national who spent many years in the United States and now is back in Germany again. And Nordmann is highly critical of all of this stuff. He actually believes that, first of all, not only is it not workable, but it has potentially a lot of, you might say, dystopic consequences, right? Potentially, you have two kind of nightmare scenarios. You have, on the one hand, the rise of another kind of totalitarian, potentially eugenics kind of agenda coming from this. Is this rain? This is rain, isn't it? For those of you out there in the audience who don't, there's a lot of rain. Rain. And the other scenario, the other nightmare scenario, is for this to actually be left open to the free market. So those who can actually get their hands on anything that could be enhancing would then be able to kind of monopolize it for their own evil purposes, right? So there are these political nightmare scenarios that Nordmann wants to keep very much in the forefront based on historical precedent with regard to research that has gone down in this direction in the past. Now, I happen to think that his concerns are a bit overblown, actually. Not that they're not concerns, they're a load of concerns. But I think they're somewhat different, and I will be talking about those later on. But so what you generally see within the difference between the United States and Europe on this converging technologies agenda is that the Europeans are more consistently critical about this, but at the same time they feel they do need to play a kind of catch-up role because of the potential economic benefits that having people, let's say, being able to live, work longer, more years, to be able to pay into social insurance systems and so forth. So there's a kind of practical reason that for the Europeans to be interested in this, even though ideologically they are not very well disposed toward it. And that's kind of the state of play at the moment. Like I said... Okay. All right. Now, I want to talk about an important historical precedent for this project that goes even before Warren Weaver and the rise of molecular biology. And it goes back to the 19th century. And it has to do with an issue that people always immediately raise whenever we talk about converging technologies. Because if you look at this thing from the original NSF document, one implication of this, obvious implication is, if this stuff works, and if it's done on any kind of large scale, it will be incredibly invasive, right? It will actually get literally under people's skins, right? I mean, it will transform their bodies. We're not talking about just, old-style surveillance. We're talking about really getting in there, okay? And so this issue of the integrity of the human body, right, is the first thing usually that critics will bring up, because the integrity of the human body is very closely associated with classical notions of dignity, right? Human dignity. Okay. Now, I take it most of you believe this idea of human dignity still has some validity in the 21st century. Is there anyone who thinks it's a waste of time talking about human dignity? I'm not being foolish or silly about this because, in fact, last year, a man I'm sure many of you have heard of, Steven Pinker, the developmental linguist and great spokesperson for evolutionary psychology and so forth, published an article, I believe it was in the New Republic in the United States, called The Stupidity of Dignity. The Stupidity of Dignity. Okay? And that basically, and what he's arguing about there, he's arguing against specifically, the specific target is President Bush's bioethics panel. Remember President Bush? He had this bioethics panel that was very much concerned about, basically what should be the appropriate American response to all of these developments. Stem cell research was in particular the issue that got very much politicized here and led this bioethics panel basically recommend an end to stem cell research funded by the United States government, which of course meant everybody else started taking it up. But Pinker is writing against that and about this the whole thinking along the lines of the Bush bioethics panel, which was very much influenced by ideas of natural law, right? And where ideas of human dignity tend to be grounded, right? That there is a kind of essential human nature that cannot be violated, and one of the conditions of that is the integrity of the human body. Okay? And Pinker says, what a stupid, silly idea. We are not going to be able to make any major biomedical progress that can actually benefit people in the 21st century unless we drop this idea of dignity. Because we have just got to get used to the fact that we're going to be putting all kinds of things into us. And there's going to be all kinds of artificial things happening to us, and we'll be engaged with them. And that is just the future. There is no natural space where only the human exists and nothing doesn't, and nothing else does. Okay? So Pinker says dignity is a stupid idea. Okay. But he's not the first, and he certainly won't be the last. And what I want to do is talk about an earlier precedent, which was quite interesting, especially in the European context. And Saint-Simon. Count Saint-Simon. Now, Now, the history of positivism as a movement, very strong intellectual movement in Latin America, as a political movement, in fact, much stronger than in Europe. And the name is, and the movement of positivism, which is this idea that you should have society run on scientific principles, right? And not only on scientific principles, but there's a sense in which science should occupy the position formerly held by the Roman Catholic Church, right? Auguste Comte, right, whose motto, "Order and Progress," appears on the Brazilian flag, right? This was the idea, right? So in other words, the Roman Catholic Church, with its great aspiration to unify all of humanity under one governmental structure, you know, St. Augustine's City of God sort of thing, that was the right idea, the right institutional structure. The problem was the ideas were wrong, right? Get rid of the Bible, put in science. But the institutional structure is basically right. Okay. Now, Saint-Simon was the person who basically sort of gave Comte a lot of his ideas. Comte was for a while his secretary. Saint-Simon was an aristocrat, a French aristocrat, who died in the 1820s. And in 1814, he published a very interesting book, which resonates, I think, with the European Union context. The Reorganization of Europe. Okay? Now, this book was published in the wake of Napoleon's defeat. And again, Saint-Simon was saying, Napoleon had the right idea, unify Europe. But he wasn't really the man for the job. But he had the right idea. So we shouldn't drop that idea. We should move forward with scientific principles. Okay? Now, the important scientific principle that Saint-Simon thought was very important, because when he was talking about reorganizing Europe, the word reorganization is actually an explicit reference to what Adam Smith was talking about with regard to labor. You have to reorganize labor to make it productive. Right? So you've got all these people, but they're not organized in the right way to actually be able to produce wealth on a reliable basis. Right? And this is what capitalism enables you to do. Capitalism adds a certain level of intelligence into the economy. Okay? Call it intellectual capital, if you will. Right? That then makes it more productive. This was Adam Smith's original message. Saint-Simon's innovation was to say, this should be applied to politics. This should be the way the state's organized. Okay. Now, the first principle that Saint-Simon thought was going to be necessary to get this reorganization done was that you would have to revise ideas of possession and property. Okay? And as you know, in capitalism, there is an enormous amount of hostility to landowners, right, as rent seekers, right? We heard about rents this morning, right? In other words, they don't use their land productively, right? They basically get money from it just by virtue of the fact they own it. Mere possession, mere property somehow entitles them to something. But that's just, as it were, an accident of history. Right? They were born into it. Right? So they inherit this land, and what? They can now charge anything they want for people to be on it? That's irrational. You're letting the past dictate the future if you do things on that basis. Well, Saint-Simon says the next step in this line of thinking, okay, is to basically say, why should human beings be thought to own their own bodies? Sure, you're born with your body, but who says you're the best one to control it? Who says, you know, just because it's in, just because you've got it, you were born with it, it's a complete accident. Somebody else might know better how to manage your body. Okay? And the point is, if they don't figure that out, we're going to have to pay for the consequences. So this then becomes a justification, right, as it were, for a kind of collective state ownership of all of the bodies, and then a reorganization according to principles that will benefit all the citizens. Okay? And this was the original plan for the reorganization of Europe, was to basically get rid of the final frontier of rent-seeking, and that is the dignity of the human body. That is the last frontier of rent-seeking. That is the ultimate religious mystification of matter, is to say you own your own body. Okay? This was actually very influential, very powerful kind of idea in justifying collective ownership throughout the 19th century, this idea. Now, against that backdrop, okay, that we're talking about here with Saint-Simon, Saint-Simon had his own version of ENVIC, you might say. He had his own converging technologies agenda, right, in the first quarter of the 19th century, so exactly 200 years ago. And so I kind of, as it were, provide a kind of paraphrase, you might say. So if Saint-Simon were writing now, what he would say, right, if the sociologist can think it, right, so Saint-Simon is thinking about a general social science that would actually figure out the terms of the reorganization of society, right? The architects can build it, right? So the architects, what he's imagining here, and this is very influential also, is the idea that that part of the reorganization of society is, of course, the physical reorganization of society. How you lay out the streets, the buildings, things of that kind. So you need architects. This becomes very important kind of thing in the École Polytechnique in France, right? The idea of city planning, which becomes a very important issue as the 19th century progresses. This is all very much Saint-Simon idea. And what it is basically taking control of the external environment as a way of being able to organize people effectively. Now, the difference nowadays is, instead of doing it from the outside, nanotechnology would do it from the inside. We would re-engineer the bodies from the inside, so we wouldn't have to do it from the outside. There's the difference there. Now, the medical people have a very big role in this reorganization of Europe. And as you know, medicine was a very advanced science in France in the early 19th century, and was in fact very often promoted as a fundamental social science. Because medicine in France was very much understood on the public hygiene model, right? Where you imagine something like a social organism, right, which you administer to, right, and health is about that, right? Where in a sense it is a collective responsibility, right, that needs to be administered to on a regular basis. And so medicine occupies the role that biotechnology occupies now. And then finally, right, playing the role of the information technology today is the police. So Saint-Simon, very much part of his program, right, is this idea that one needs professional police forces. As you know, police forces really just get invented in the early 19th century in the kind of way we understand them today. The whole idea of there being science of, you know, criminology, right? All of these kinds of disciplines, right? Surveillance of people, right? Being able to figure out, you know, the kinds of things you may remember. Tom Cruise was in this movie a few years ago that Steven Spielberg did, Minority Report, about pre-crime, figuring out what kind of people are going to commit the crime and stopping them before they do it. Well, of course, the technology that goes on in that movie is very advanced, and it is very much part of what converging technologies would allow us to do. But Saint-Simon was already talking about this, except that he was interested in things like bumps in the head, you know, the kind of phrenology, all of that kind of stuff that was very popular in the early 19th century. But the spirit of the enterprise was very similar. Okay, the sciences change their content, but the functions that they would perform in terms of the reorganization of society are very similar. Okay, and again, what is the context of this? The reorganization of Europe. They're very much like what we're talking about now in the European Union. And if you read this document of Saint-Simon, one of the things that Saint-Simon is very concerned about, and he's not the only one concerned about this, if you look at his contemporaries across the European continent, to Hegel, for example, very famously, there's a great concern about America. Okay, America is about 50 years old at this point, the United States in particular, and there is this concern that Europe is going to be overtaken. Okay, so those concerns are there too in the early 19th century, as something that would happen in the future. So this reorganization needs to take place. Okay, so this kind of idea of converging technologies, while it very much has a very futuristic sound to it, and a lot of the science isn't on the table, it nevertheless has been a very influential idea, not just as a general idea, but even in terms of the general way in which one would go about doing it, the general strategy behind it, and the general purposes to which it would be put. And a lot of social science research and a lot of political movement in the 19th and 20th centuries are, in a way, outgrowths of this, including movements in Latin America, okay, as ways of reorganizing society. I mean, one of the things I will talk a bit about tomorrow, I don't think I'll get to it today, will be the role that eugenics played in this, in Latin America. Okay, and the issue of biology generally is a touchy topic in Latin America, because this is very much part of what's going on, and it's getting discussed also in the United States and Europe as well. Now, I should bring up a point here about, you know, I'm mentioning eugenics and a lot of the history that I've been alluding to. You know, we sort of know what happened with regard to Nazism and other forms of eugenic programs. Also the way in which science, in this very totalizing way, got used for totalitarianism, because obviously that was also influenced in some way by this original agenda that Saint-Simon had. Right, so we know in a way a lot of all of these very bad historical precedents that have taken place. But I think one of the things that's very interesting about this whole debate as it's happening now in the 21st century, and this is kind of why history always seems to repeat itself, is there's generational shift. Okay? And when there's generational shift, a couple of things happen that are very important, and we take this for granted very much. The first one is there's a loss of historical memory. Okay, so for example, I'm sure most of you didn't know about the precedent, the connection between molecular biology and this, or the connection between Saint-Simon and this, right? I mean, and one of the things that happens when there's generational shift is not only that there's this loss of historical memory, but it happens in a very active way because things get relabeled. So nobody's going around saying, hey, I'm for eugenics. Right? Nobody's saying that. Right, that isn't good. You can't do good anticipatory governance that way. Right? It doesn't go good with a focus group to say, hey, would you endorse a positive eugenics policy? Say, ooh, no, no. You know? But in fact, if you're talking about genetic counseling, very popular idea. Right? Genetic counseling. Offered for free in national health services. But what's the difference? You know, back in the 1920s, there was also a little anticipatory governance going on. We got this in the United States. Planned Parenthood, which is seen as a very good thing. But this came out of the eugenics movement. Okay? And so what happens is, and of course, because the science is different, right? The science is different. We're talking about doing different things to people now than we were talking about 50 or 100 or 150 or 200 years ago, right? One can talk about them in fresh ways. So that when one does genetic counseling, right, one is able to do stuff like show parents, you know, photographs of chromosomes, and you can find the gene that's bad, and we can obliterate that immediately, you know, and all that. I mean, we can do that kind of targeted thing, which we couldn't do in the past. So the whole science of it changes the way in which it's thought about. And so then what this means then is there's a complete disconnection with a lot of these older issues. And so people start to think, oh, these are just fresh new issues that we need to think about in brand new ways without bringing in any of this historical baggage. And I think this would be a big mistake because, in fact, if you look into the history more and more, you see the similarities in terms of the styles of arguments that are made and so forth. And I think one area where I've done research on this, because I think this is now very obvious, is with regard to a change in conception that's just taken place over the last 30 years. in the 1970s, when I was a student, sociobiology, have you heard of this term, sociobiology? This was a book by E.O. Wilson, a professor at Harvard, specialist on ants, and was basically giving a very strong kind of genetically based argument for the origins of various social traits. It wasn't that he actually knew much genetics, but rather he was making the argument that given the massive genetic overlap of species, and given the similarities in forms of behavior between human beings and other animals, different, we resemble animals in different ways in different respects, that in fact, it would not be surprising to learn that, as it were, we have lots of different bits, as it were, of the animal past in us, you might say. And that, in fact, explains maybe the vast majority of our behavior. Now, the context in which this argument was received in the 1970s was in a very hostile way. It was largely because the people receiving it still had very much within historical memory the Nazi past. Right, World War II ended only 30 years earlier. Right, a lot of people were still alive remembering these kinds of arguments before. Because the way this kind of argument was being interpreted was saying, well, you know, there's certain kinds of traits that are genetically fixed. And so, for example, all of the sort of social welfare programs that try to raise people above the original living conditions that they're from, well, it's only going to go so far. You're never really going to be able to really raise people beyond a certain point because there's a genetic ceiling. People can only be made to do certain things. Okay? So it was received in a very hostile way, not only because of the Nazi precedent, but also because of this very, it seemed to imply, very conservative, right, anti-welfarist sort of politics. Now, fast forward 30 years. And we have this field now called evolutionary psychology. Okay? It says largely the same thing. It does more experiments, though. Has more data. It has a very clever marketing device called SSSM, which is a stereotyping of what social scientists do, which makes them backward. And this SSSM means Standard Social Science Model. How does a social scientist explain people's behavior? Purely in terms of their differences. Right? So in other words, and the differences are always explained in environmental terms. People live in different places and they behave differently. You change the environment, you change the people. Right? You change the culture, you change the people. Right? Very little explanatory worth is placed on universal things. Things that don't change when you change the culture. Things that don't change about people when you change the environment. And evolutionary psychology claims that's what they talk about. The stuff that doesn't change. Okay? And that in fact the potential for change is really quite small. And the way you see that is in fact we have got a lot more different societies than we do patterns of human behavior. Right? The variation of different societies is enormous. But you can predict people within a certain range that's much narrower. That's their claim, okay? And so they relaunch this genetic argument. And it also gets relaunched in the context where a lot of the same political points are being made too. In particular, the limits to any kind of social welfare programs that go beyond a certain point. So our friend Steven Pinker published a book in 2002 called The Blank Slate. I don't know if any of you have ever read this book. It's a very instructive book because what Pinker is arguing in this book is he's arguing against this concept. Right? He's are people familiar with this concept of the blank slate, what that means in the history of philosophy? The tabula rasa? Right? You ever read into that? The tabula rasa? People, how many are familiar with this? Okay, a few of you are. Okay. Well, so the idea here, right, is that, you know, we are products of our environment. We are like a blank slate or a wax tablet, as Aristotle originally said, and experience etches itself on us. Right, so we start, and so, you know, if you take that idea seriously, right, you can turn people into anything. And of course, that idea was very influential in the 18th century in terms of the drive toward public education systems.
right? Because if you believe in tabula rasa, education means a lot, right? Because you can really change people if you instruct them properly. So you want national education systems, make sure everybody learns the right stuff, so they become fully functioning citizens, right? So education is very much part of that agenda. Now, if you don't believe that, if you believe that, in fact, people are already pretty much born a certain way, and they can't change all that much, then education, at least, is not a big state-mandated thing. Okay, so this had a lot of political consequences throughout history, and it also was very important in supporting egalitarian ideals, of course. Because if you give everybody the same education, then potentially they would be sufficiently similar, at least to get on with each other, to treat each other with equal respect, and as it were, a lot of those normative ideas associated with egalitarianism, which ultimately come from theology, all children are the same God, image and likeness of God, humans are all the same, ultimately, in spiritual terms, could actually be realized at a psychological and political level. So tabula rasa is a very important idea historically in sort of promoting progressive politics. But Pinker's argument is it's empirically unfounded. Okay? And it's empirically unfounded, and what it does is it leads to utopian thinking. And this is a bad word for him. Now let me ask you a question. And this is I wonder about this from the standpoint of how you younger people think about this. How many of you think of utopian as a negative term? As a negative. How many people think of utopian as negative? That when somebody says, that's utopian, you think of that as a negative thing. You do. Anyone else? Put your hands up. Be honest. Remember, the camera's on me, not on you. Okay, so we're talking maybe, what, 10%, maybe 15%? Okay. Well, if you read Steven Pinker, he wants you to realize utopian is very bad. Why is it bad? Well, because if you believe in this tabula rasa view, right, then, as it were, the sky's the limit with regard to how you could change people, right? Because we're just blank slates, after all. So you can put anything on people, okay? And if they don't actually come around to what you want to put in their minds, then there must be some problem here. Right, because the theory is correct, the people must be the problem. Right, they're not cooperating with the educational system sufficiently. Right, they're not moving fast enough. They are not thinking the right way. Right, so then it becomes, as it were, a moral problem for them as individuals that they are not conforming appropriately. Because if they are schooled in a certain way, they should behave in a certain way. Okay. And so what Pinker wants to argue is that these utopian ideas, based on false notions of psychology and false notions that there's no human nature, right, has led to an enormous amount of violence and destruction and basically all the evils that we've seen, especially in the 20th century. And he's quite happy to put communism and Nazism and all of them in the same basket. Okay. And that what we need to do is that we need to scale down our expectations with regard to policy. We cannot say that we can just transform all of society and get an equal society and all of that, because equality is not natural. Variation is natural. Okay? How do we know variation's natural? Darwin told us. So we've got this book, The Darwinian Left. Has anyone heard of this book? It's a small book. I recommend it. It's small. That's not the only reason. It's a little pamphlet is published. The London School of Economics is a very interesting place, as you know. It has no natural science faculty, but it has a natural science propaganda division, you might say. That is a Darwin project, which publishes a lot of pamphlets on basically the social scientific implications of Darwinism. And this is one of the books in that series. And it's authored by another person very much in the same vein, Peter Singer. Now, you know about Peter Singer, I hope, the great philosopher of animal liberation. Peter Singer's argument in this book, The Darwinian Left, is that if you want to be a responsible, progressive person in the 21st century, you've got to give up on Marx and take on board Darwin. And what that means is that you've got to realize that egalitarianism is just not on the cards. That is not a rational goal for any society at all. That what we need to do is we need to respect variation. And that means we've got to respect limits, and we have to realize in particular the limits of state intervention with regard to trying to change people's lives. Okay? Now, Singer is willing to go quite far on this. And I don't know if I have it here. Yes, maybe I can. I'm going to read you a quote from this book. Because this is how far that Singer thinks we should be willing to go in terms of scaling down our public policy expectations in light of what we know about biology. So here's Singer. While Darwinian thought has no impact on the priority we give to equality as a moral or political ideal, it gives us grounds for believing that since men and women play different roles in reproduction, they may also differ in their inclinations and temperaments in ways that best promote the reproductive prospects of each sex. This is in the context of explaining why more women do not become chief executives and top people even after affirmative action is in place. Okay? This is an example of the kind of thing we're talking about here, of scaling down policy expectations. So what Singer is imagining, and this is the argument, right, we have had, whatever, 25 years of, right, affirmative action for various previously disadvantaged groups, giving them advantages they previously did not have in the hope of creating some kind of equality between them. We find that, in fact, after doing this for one generation, there is still lag. That lag is most likely never going to go away. We are wasting our money and time continuing to do it. That is basically the argument. At least he's not making this as a dogmatic statement, but he's proposing this as something that leftists need to take seriously. That maybe there is, as it were, a gender ceiling to achievement. Okay? This is in a book called The Darwinian Left. Okay. Now, and as you know, if you look at the history of feminism over the last 25, 30 years, you will see that it's moved in very strange kinds of directions, which in a way has very much blurred the original interest in egalitarianism. Right? And so Singer is not, as it were, speaking in a vacuum here. He is not speaking in some, you know, from some crazy location in politics. But he's speaking in a place where I think a lot of people will take seriously. Okay? And the interesting thing about these arguments, right, is that they are biologically based arguments. They are arguments that when you read them, and this is true of Pinker, it's true of Singer, it was true 30 years ago of E.O. Wilson as well. What you typically have is a very strange situation. You've got this biological style explanations being brought up, and then you have some social political phenomena that's being explained by them. But what you rarely have is any serious engagement with the social science literature that actually deals with that phenomena. You know, so for example, all the various complex reasons why affirmative action has not worked as fast as people had hoped it to work. You don't get an engagement with that literature. You just, as it were, get the bare fact that after a generation of doing it, it doesn't go very far, therefore there's a deeper problem that we haven't seen yet because we don't want to take biology seriously. That is a very common feature of all this literature we're talking about. And this is literature, right, that in a way has a wide public audience. These are books that all are widely circulated. They get reviewed very widely. These are very well-placed people in terms of their academic positions. All of them are speaking outside their expertise. I think that's worth saying. None of these people are really expert in these topics that they are offering these very influential opinions on. In fact, you people in the room probably know more about the actual facts that they are trying to explain than they do. But nevertheless, this is very much part of the culture that we're in at the moment. And the thing that's very interesting is the people who buy these arguments are not familiar with the historical backstory through the way in which biology and the social sciences have interacted with each other over the last 200 years. Now, I published a book a couple of years ago called The New Sociological Imagination, which is basically trying to get people to remember this, right? To basically realize that, in fact, the histories of the biological and the social sciences have always been very strongly intertwined with each other. And in a sense, this biological move is not, as it were, a new move from nowhere, but is in fact one that's always been there within the social sciences of varying degrees of influence. And that even though the content of the science changes, the spirit of the arguments remain the same in terms of their political function and so forth. Before I open this up to more general questions, I want to just draw these two strands. I've been talking about two different strands here from biology. The first one is the proper converging technologies agenda. And this is very futuristic, and this involves actually motivating the idea that you can actually re-engineer the human being. And this is very much inspired by bringing in a lot of physicists and chemists into biology to think about the human being and to think about society as kind of a big mechanism, you might say. Right? Just as it was in the 19th century with Comte and Saint-Simon. And so the idea here is that you can change human beings. Okay? The trick is you can't preserve their dignity. Right? The territorial integrity of the human body goes out the window with this. And what it means to actually be human and how that differs from non-human is not so clear. Okay? And I will have a lot more to say about that point later on. The other point which I'm bringing up now with Singer and Steven Pinker's book and E.O. Wilson is there is still this other strand of biology that's very much present, very much part of the mainstream history of biology, that is to say biology before the physicists and the chemists got involved, right, which has to do with the unchangeability of things. Right? The degree to which there are various ceilings, there are various limits, right, which have to do with the kinds of creatures we are. Now, I have to say, both of these arguments are very scary. Both of them, as it were, in a way would render traditional social science obsolete in different ways. Okay? But they do not sit very comfortably with each other. That's the interesting point, right? I mean, you know, there's a weird issue here, right? How are we to think about the human body in this new biological phase? Is it something we can re-engineer, like a machine? Or is it something that is so fixed in its limits that we have to disown all traditional progressive politics? I mean, these things do not sit too well together, okay? But what's missing from the discussion is the traditional space that the social sciences occupied and the kinds of political possibilities that were made possible through mainstream social science. So, for example, you're not hearing a lot of discussion here about participatory politics or even parliamentary democracy or anything like that. You know, communicative rationality, that's not around here either. All those kind of mainstream social science ideas and their normative side are not present in this discussion. It's these two kinds of issues, these two versions of biology that are present. Okay, I will stop here because I think in a sense this gives you kind of a sense of the opening move. As you notice, I only put up two overheads. I had loads, right? But I wanted to go through this reasonably slowly so you get a flavor of what this is about. But I think it's fair to say that if these biologically based arguments, both from the converging technology side and from the sort of neo-Darwinian side, they are really occupying the space the social sciences and progressive politics previously occupied. And so in a sense, for those of us who are social scientists, and for those of us who, as it were, still have a commitment to sort of traditional forms of progressive politics, such as the welfare state, this is the challenge that, in a sense, we're faced with dealing with this, which is very much, you know, in our face now, and increasingly influencing policy agendas, not just in the science policy world, but also in health policy, education policy, all kinds of policy. Okay? And with that, I'll stop, and I will take whatever questions you have. I hope this is not too much for an opening move, but I wanted to give you a flavor of what the issues are here. So questions? Yes.
My name is Lorena Rivera.
Does she need a microphone?
Gracias. My name is Lorena Rivera from the London School of Economics. I have a question on how this convergent technologies agenda, or more generally, interdisciplinary science could influence economic theory. And I'm saying that in the light of on how you see reality as a systemic, very systemic, through a systemic approach, whereas economists, at least when participating in interdisciplinary projects, we are criticized most of the times to having a very, very short approach or very reductionist view of reality. And if there is influence, how do you think international political economy could affect this?
Okay. First point I think to make about economics here is, in fact, I think of all the social sciences, economics is actually the one that works best with all this in the following way. Economics as a science, especially if we think about neoclassical economics, okay, so let's put the Marxists and the other people aside. You might say neoclassical economics is ontologically light. Right? In other words, it is not... I mean, sociology is committed to the idea of society. And historically, that idea has been exclusively about human beings. And these are all very obvious things if you're a sociologist. And political science, same sort of thing, right? And one of the ways you can see that, of course, is the great difficulty of trying to incorporate animals into sociology, into political science, into those traditional social science disciplines. Economics is not a problem, because economics, right, in a sense, is about relationships, and it's about formal relationships, right? So we could be talking about firms, individuals. We could be talking about populations of animals. After all, decision theory has been incredibly influential. Game theory has been influential in population genetics. That's where the idea of the selfish gene comes from, right? Richard Dawkins, right, is getting this from W.D. Hamilton, who's influenced by game theory. Right? And so the idea, and so you can transfer the same set of equations, the same formulas, the same template, and talk about many different things. So from that standpoint, economists are very useful, because they don't, you know, they can enter into the discussion without fussing about dignity or humanity or society or anything like that. Right? They just need to know, you know, what the field of play is that can be kind of understood as markets. And anything can be understood as a market. Right? You just have to know the boundaries of it and so forth. So from that standpoint, this is why, if you look at the book, The Darwinian Left, and I do recommend that book, it's not by accident that it's in this LSC series, because, in fact, Singer's arguments against very extravagant kind of utopian social policies are based on game theoretic concerns. Okay? That's all he continually falls back on those kinds of economic arguments. Okay? Another place where economics, I think, has a very strong role, because so far I've been talking kind of about the Darwinian stuff here, but on specifically the converging technology side, look, you know, even in the European context, there is this issue of efficiency. Are human beings used, as it were, as efficiently as possible? You know, are we as efficient as we can be in terms of producing wealth? Are we as productive as we can be? Okay? This is, in a sense, the bottom line question that makes this kind of a pressing concern at the state level. Right? And as I was pointing out with regard to Saint-Simon, back in the 19th century, right, the big conceptual move for him was to think about the society as having a kind of division of labor that can be reorganized, very much as Adam Smith thought about things, right, with the factory, right? I mean, so the literal analogy, right, is from Adam Smith's understanding of how you rationalize factory work to make it as productive as possible through reorganizing labor, and then society as a kind of factory for wealth production through reorganization. And see, and in this context, Saint-Simon, again following up the lead of Adam Smith, but making it very clear, was very explicit that you actually needed a class of knowledge managers. Okay, and he uses a phrase kind of like this, right? And as it were, these would be, as it were, the people who know how to rationalize society, how to put people together in the right way to be able to maximize output. Okay, and the Converging Technologies agenda revisits this, but instead of thinking about it as something that's done externally by rearranging, you know, the way in which people move around and watching them, does it internally through the biomedical system. Okay, but ultimately it's an efficiency imperative. It's an efficiency imperative that is driving this. And that's very much an economic argument. Okay, so I actually think economists, because the economists are very agnostic on the uses to which their knowledge is put. So they can participate very well in all of these things. I actually don't, I mean, I think the problem comes when you have ideologically committed economists. Okay, and of course then there will be problems. But those economists, of course, you know, like Marxists and so forth, right, they already share a lot of ontological assumptions with sociologists and other people like that. Okay, about what economics is for, and you know, and about labor theory. You know, when you start to get into the labor theory of value, and you believe that that's, you know, as it were, an identifying feature of human beings as opposed to animals or machines, right? Then you start introducing qualitative distinctions, right? That's when the economists can't participate, it seems to me, is when you start introducing those qualitative notions. But of course, neoclassical economists don't do that. Okay, so that's the answer to your question. I'm going to take the student first and then move to you. Yeah. Your name? Someone give him a microphone.
Well, I mean, I just have one question, which I think is what maybe Peter Singer, David Meadows, and all this like that tried to highlight. Is I get the impression they don't associate so many values with the statement that there are issues of biology and like, inherits. I think this is just a reaction to the dominance of tabula rasa, that we should still consider our biological heritage. And I think it's still relevant to consider these issues within social sciences, which is often affected.
No, I agree with you, okay? And in fact, when I wrote, if you look at this book, The New Sociological Imagination, and this will come out in the next couple of days as well, I am by no means against re-engaging with biology. In fact, I've been very, in the United Kingdom, I have been one of the people who's been trying to push forward the idea that there should be special, that our the ESRC, the Economic and Social Research Council, should actually provide seminars or various initiatives for more social scientists to actually learn biology. You know, let's say in mid-career or something, to understand all these different aspects of biology that are increasingly influential in social and policy matters, so that social scientists can have independent views on these issues. Because I do think, historically, what's happened, especially in the recent past, and I talk about this a lot in The New Sociological Imagination, social scientists like to, they don't want to engage with the biology directly, they don't understand it, they find it boring, whatever. You know, as soon as somebody's talking about a rat, they say, but that's not a human being, how could that be relevant to anything, right? I mean, that's a very standard social science move. But also, a lot of social scientists like to get their criticisms of biology secondhand from other biologists. So as you know, people like Stephen Jay Gould, right? In the UK, Stephen Rose. Okay, I mean, there are certain biologists who, in fact, spend a lot of their career scaring people away from taking biology seriously. Okay, and of course, for a lot of social scientists, that's good enough for them, right? If all these important biologists say that, you know, we shouldn't worry about evolution, you know, that it happens in time frames that are too massive to influence historic time, which is what Stephen Jay Gould always used to say, you know, then that's good enough for a lot of social scientists because they're looking for an excuse not to engage with it. And I think that's really still the dominant attitude among certainly sociologists, is to quote somebody like Gould or Rose and say, look, Richard Dawkins doesn't know what he's talking about. Look at what Gould says. But that's not the way to deal with it.
The social scientists have to study the biology themselves. They don't have to get PhDs in the subject, but they should engage with this literature more and develop their own critiques of the literature on its own terms. And one of the best ways to do, you know, to begin to do that is to go through the footnotes of books like Steven Pinker's and just look at the faulty inferences that are being made and the way in which, you know, because what you will see in a book like Pinker's, if you go to the notes, is he will cite all of the various articles and books in social science that he read just for the conclusions, just for the data, without any knowledge of the theories or the methods that were used, and therefore without any sense of the limitations and the debate surrounding the way in which this data has been brought about. So there's a lot of misunderstanding that goes on the biological side, which is a good place for social scientists to begin to engage this stuff. Okay? And the problem is most social scientists just aren't willing to do that. But I do think that there needs to be special effort. So I'm not against, I don't have this traditional anti, you know, biology view at the outset. We need to have our own biological views, basically. So, for example, we need to have our views about what do we make of this business that humans and other animals genetically overlap 90-95%. What is the significance of that from a sociological standpoint, from a normative standpoint? That isn't important. We don't really have a clear view about it. We don't have a clear debate on that. That's an important point. You see, I mean, that my book tries to engage with that, but I do think that's an important thing. I by no means believe we should just wipe, you know, just ignore this or just dismiss it out of hand. Yeah. Sorry, we. I know, and I'll get to you. That's sorry.
Yeah.
I have a short question. Because you were talking about LSE, so there's another scholar which I found very interesting. That's Christopher Badcock.
And oh, yeah.
He developed this concept of psychodarwinism. And he's actually he's a proper sociologist and well, a psychoanalyst. Where do you see this concept of psychodarwinism, even if it's grounded on a, from my point of view, on a very relatively weak empirical basis? Because he, well, looked at the genome of the, or this, of the mouse and identified the identification of the female behavior. But where do you see this concept of psychodarwinism in regaining ground in all this debate from the social science, from proper social science, because I think this is a social science approach.
So this is psycho-Darwinism.
Yeah.
Psycho-Darwinism. And so does he actually deal with human beings this way?
Yeah.
Why don't you keep your mic on?
Yeah. And and the evolution of society. So he's coming from this somehow also from you know, Wilson.
Well, yeah, I know he's got a textbook on evolutionary psychology, basically, that does get used in sociology courses. Yes, it's true. I mean, one of the things that Dirk is mentioning here is the fact that there are a few sociologists, people trained in sociology, who have kind of bought into this. Right, and are working on this. I'm not against it. I do think, though, the big problem with a lot of this stuff is it dehistoricizes. Okay, I mean, here's a big problem I think with a lot of Darwinian explanations. It isn't so much that they're looking in the genes or that they're talking about things being inherited. That's fine. The problem is when you make an assumption that you might say, I mean, I sometimes talk about this as a kind of action at a distance explanation. You know, in other words, that our common ancestry with a wolf in certain respects, or with a mouse in certain respects, and we have certain genetic patterns that are common to those creatures that we have a common ancestor with, explains behavior patterns that are similar to the wolf or the mouse in this respect. Because that's kind of how these explanations work. There's a sense in which that evolutionary explanations are so-called deep historical explanations, right? There's a sense in which there's a kind of continuity. And I think from that really dehistoricizes, right? It makes it look like that there is some sense in which causation kind of remains intact over all of those millions of years. Okay, and so one needs a much more sophisticated kind of explanation about the interaction of the genes with the environment. Okay, so for example, one thing that I think is a promising thing, and I don't know if Babcock goes into this, but if you're going to start going down this route of evolutionary explanations for human behavior, there is this issue of neurohistory, okay, where you look at neuroscience and you look at the way in which, you know, neurons get activated, and there's a sense in which genetically we have all this potential in terms of how our neurons can be activated, but environmental conditions can turn certain ones on and off on a regular basis. And this is especially in relation to the kinds of food and drink we take, drugs we take, and so forth. Because these are things that we regularly ingest, and they create certain neural patterns. And genetically, we're quite open in a way how they can be formed, but they do tend to get formed regularly, and then subsequent generations tend to be susceptible to the same thing. There's evidence for that. So there's this field called neurohistory, which some historians are into, which in a way gives you a more nuanced side to this. You know, so once people start drinking coffee a lot in the 18th century, they start thinking quite differently about things, which then, you know, may explain why people get to become greater risk takers with regard to economic matters or political matters. Of course, that's not the only explanation. But the point is, if that's, as it were, part of the background noise of your mind, that you're constantly ingesting caffeine or you're constantly ingesting certain kind of alcohol in a certain kind of environment, right? If you add all that together, you see, you can bring in a lot of these biological mechanisms at play. Some of them are, in fact, quite deeply rooted. But you're not losing the social historical dimension at the same time. So you really need to have a kind of much more rounded story. And so in principle, there are a lot of different disciplines that could be contributing to this in a very useful kind of way, I think. So I don't want to say no to any of this. But I think the problem is that the way the debate is currently being framed, it's a kind of either-or proposition. Right, very much along the lines of, you know, it's either the tabula rasa or it's genetically determined. And I think that's the big mistake. And I think insofar as social scientists ignore the biologists, they perpetuate this false dichotomy, I think. Yes, and you were...
Thank you. I would like to follow up this neurohistory thing and challenge a little bit the paradigm, this novelty which you introduced in your speech, saying this intrusion into the human body. That's nothing new. I mean, we take pills since 100 years, we take drugs since our evolution. We also take them very consciously. Neuro robots, which you explained, it's just a new instrument.
Yes.
So this is maybe a question to you, and the second thing is more maybe a remark that's about dignity. I would say it's too reductionist to say the final function of dignity, or just to combine dignity with the sanctuary of the human body. I mean, for me, dignity, for instance, is also a thing that 1 million people live with less than $1 a day.
Sure. No, I take your point entirely. I do think, in a sense, a lot of this discussion about, you know, the invasions of the human body remind me a bit of the arguments over genetically modified foods, you know, as if the foods were never, you know, as if there was some time when they weren't genetically modified. No, I agree. I think that's right. I do think, though, like you say, that the kinds of changes to our bodies that we do approve of are the ones that we do consciously, deliberately, you know, even if we don't know all the effects, in some sense we take responsibility for them, like, you know, people get drunk, you know, and do crazy things, but, you know, they nobody put the liquor bottle to their mouth, right? They did it themselves. And I think the fear, though, is that there won't be necessarily consent on these matters of invasion. I think that's the idea, right? I mean, one thing I haven't talked about yet is an ideology that has kind of arisen very much on the back of the converging technologies agenda, which in a way kind of explains some of the fears that I was alluding to. Ableism. Ableism, okay. There's this interesting German guy who lives in Canada, Ottawa. Gregor Volgren, okay, who is a quadriplegic, I believe. And he's, I don't know, you might say he's like the Dr. Strangelove of ableism. See, ableism is the idea that as we go down this converging technologies agenda, and we actually do develop technologies that enable us to clean our arteries, or, you know, boost brain-boosting drugs, right? Another example, right? There's an active debate in the UK at the moment about whether these things should be sold, or not only sold, but as it were, be made available by school systems to help kids be able to perform better on exams. Every year, in June, there's a lively discussion that takes place on this matter, okay? Now, what Volbring argues under the rubric of ableism is that as this kind of develops in a sort of free and open way, as it seems to be at the moment, right? So nobody's controlling the discussion. It just sort of happens, and then one day this stuff's allowed, right? That we're going to get to a point where people who we would normally regard as normal people, abled people, will feel disabled if they don't have the drugs in them, if they don't have the various prosthetic devices in them, right? So as it were, you are always already disabled. That becomes the normal state. That's what ableism is about, right? That everyone becomes always already disabled, and you get into this kind of, enhancement race. Right, you can end up becoming disadvantaged for jobs and things if you haven't boosted your brains this morning, right? And then, the employer tells you, well, look, you know where to get the drugs and you didn't get them. What am I supposed to do? You've got some weird purist idea about what's appropriate about human beings. Sorry, you don't get the job, okay? And so Volbring is arguing that unless we really do start thinking systematically about this, and that is to say in a regulatory fashion, and maybe even at a global level, we're going to fall into this. This is going to become a default ideology, ableism, right? Where everyone is always already disabled. Now you see, Volbring, I've talked to him about this, he's a quadriplegic. There's a kind of ironic thing here, because now everybody becomes disabled. Disability isn't just a kind of rare thing that one has kind of curious attitudes toward. Everyone starts to feel it. Becomes normal. Okay? And I think that there's a sense in which if one takes the liberal attitude that you were suggesting, right? We take stuff all the time and all this. I think that kind of opens the door to that becoming a default ideology. And I think that's, in a sense, the interesting argument about dignity turns on this. You see, but to me, I'm quite willing to play around with this. So I'm quite willing to entertain a liberal view, but I think this is an argument for regulatory thinking and global governance style thinking. It's precisely on this kind of issue, especially if we are talking about increasingly mobile labor markets. Right? I mean, because there is a practical thing to this, right? Supposing you live in a country that doesn't allow you to boost your brains because the Roman Catholic Church has a problem with it. Could be an issue, right? So, that's kind of, I might say a little bit more about that tomorrow and later, but I think that that's the thing on the horizon there, right? If one's too liberal. Yes? Oh, he needs the microphone.
I don't need the microphone.
Oh, I don't know, man. We're gonna invade your space with prosthetic device.
Okay. Two questions, maybe. I don't know how much time we have. But I want to talk about philosophy, maybe. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the interesting idea of two opposite theories, two apparent opposite theories or fields, like neuroscience, we are hardwired, and post-structuralism in the other side, all these affluents, and they have strong coincidences. I was wondering if one can explain that coincidence in the idea of immanence that is underlying those theories. And my point is that the less obvious theory, as likes too much Spinoza and used to quote him, and Antonio Damasio, the leader of neuroscientists, also has a book called Looking for Spinoza and quotes the best books of Spinoza. I don't want a deep debate on Spinoza, but I'm wondering if the idea of immanence as opposed as Hegelian transcendentalism
is
not the point which enables those different theories. That's a first question. Second point in philosophy. I think an interesting thinker in those themes is Peter Sloterdijk.
Oh, sure.
And his idea of a new ontology and his criticism of Plato, binary ontology, and his proposal of a trinary ontology with information. I mean, it's a way of looking at things not so known as the French post-structuralism, but I think it's very interesting. The third question, this is very easy.
Thank you.
You talk about a shift in the public consideration of some ideas that are really old. My question, and the same question arose when I read your work, is what's the cause of that? Do you think it's a change in the capitalism? What explains that besides the internal history of ideas? Are there some elements that should be mentioned in that sense or not? Or what if,
this is the easy question.
That's it.
Okay. So first point here is the immanence-transcendence distinction. I think one of the things, this is actually an issue, I think you're right, and tomorrow I'm going to talk about how one defines humanity, because in a sense this kind of distinction is very relevant to that. There's a question about to what extent is our humanity tied to our animal nature? You know, in other words, you know, because there is a sense in which if you transform the being enough, it becomes something else. Part of the converging technologies agenda, and I think this is the thing that makes it both interesting and scary, is it's very open-minded on this point. So somebody like Bainbridge, who I mentioned earlier, is very much a transcendence thinker. Right? He, in principle, will entertain the idea that if you really want humanity to realize its full potential, it has to at least have the option to evacuate its current carbon existence. At least should have the option. Okay, now that's very transcendent. Okay? I think, you know, one of the reasons why, people who are more attracted to the immanence view, I think are beginning to make their peace with biology in a sense. And they like the idea that, you know, that there is this kind of grounded nature and the whole idea, because, you know, there's a way, you know, if you read Pinker's book, The Blank Slate, of course it looks like, and with Peter Singer as well, it looks like at one level it's very negative with regard to progressive politics. But within, you know, the history of philosophy, one might see it as a kind of, sort of Epicurean kind of move where, you know, if you know Epicurus, the idea that you kind of become comfortable with in your own skin, right? You realize that you're a transient being, and as it were, you try to avoid pain, right, in this brief period that you are around. And you don't start having aspirations that just cause you endless pain, because you end up just thinking about things that are way beyond your control and way beyond the kind of being that you are. You sort of misunderstand your position, essentially, and that is the source of all pain. And somebody like, I think, especially Peter Singer, is appealing to that in asking the left to scale down its political ambitions. Because if you look at the history of leftist politics, and those of you who do know the intellectual history of this, will realize, right, it is very much a secular version of the salvation story, right, whereby we sort of get out of original sin and we manage to reach this kind of heaven on earth. The rhetoric behind the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and so forth. Transcendence all the way. And of course this leads to lots of violence, right, and after two centuries of it, people like Peter Singer come along and say, don't you learn anything from this? Don't you learn the limitations of the kinds of beings we are? Okay, and I think that's kind of there's this kind of deep kind of metaphysical thing there about what kind of creatures we are as human beings. And on the one hand, some of these converging technologies guys want us to think of ourselves out of carbon into silicon. That is the revolutionary move to make. Whereas the other people are saying, no, you have to realize all those moves fail. And they all just lead to a lot of pain and violence. And so that's kind of where I think we are on this. So I do think that's a very deep kind of issue. I mean, Sloterdijk is a very interesting guy on all this, because he's probably the philosopher, if you're interested in kind of people who are really trying to come to grips with the ontology of the human that comes as a result of this discussion, I think you should read his stuff, Peter Sloterdijk's stuff, because he's quite open-minded on the matter, and really tries to draw in the entire philosophical tradition with Nietzsche and Heidegger and so forth. He's been a very controversial figure in Germany, as you know. But I think someone who is really trying to come to grips with this at a philosophical level, very seriously. But I think, why don't I just stop there, because I will be returning to this tomorrow, actually, I think, in more. Because this business, being poised between God and the apes, right? This is kind of the human problem, right? People are never quite happy just being human beings, right? Is there other... Is that right? Okay. Okay, well, look, thank you very much. Thank you.